cool the silence that we don't dare speak. There's a wall between us and a river so deep. We keep pretending that there's nothing wrong. There's a cold of silence and I can't go on.
I'm Alan Ward. This is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 19th of March, 2010. Newcomers should look into cuttingthroughthematrix.com website and download hundreds of talks I've given in the past for free, and bookmark the other sites you'll see on the front page there, because these are the official sites, and once in a while the other sites go down. That way you always have someone, some site to pick from, to choose from. And it's cuttingthroughthematrix.com.org.net.us.ca. Alan Watt, cuttingthroughthematrix.ca. There's also Alan Watt, sentinel.eu, the European site, which is good for transcripts as well as audios. All the same audios are up there for download, but the transcripts you can choose from the various languages of Europe. And there's quite a lot of have been done already, because I've got some good people working on them. There's also cuttingthrough.jagmas.com. That's a very dependable site that tends to stay up when the other ones go down as well. And remember that you are the audience who bring me to you. I don't work as the way normal hosts do. Generally, they get their income from advertisers. And what you hear on this show for advertising is paid by the advertisers directly to RBN for the airtime and for the staff and equipment and their bills and the transmission of the show. So it's up to you to keep me going by going into cuttingthroughthematrix.com, see what I have for sale, and you can buy the books I've written, you can buy the discs, DVD discs, and CDs as well, with sometimes 50 shows on them. You can also donate to me through PayPal or any means that you wish to purchase or donate. You can go through from the U.S. to Canada. Personal check is good to Canada. International postal money order from the U.S. to Canada. I stress international, that's what you tell them. Otherwise, you get the green one, that's internal only. You can't cash it here. You can also use MoneyGram, Western Union, or PayPal, or cash. If you want to order through PayPal, just give me the donation from the PayPal, the button there on the website, and send a separate email with the order, and I'll get it out to you. Same across the rest of the world. You can use PayPal, MoneyGram, cash, or Western Union. That's all up to you. And I chop around too to see what one's cheaper. It's amazing the differences in some countries just to wire some cash through. And for those who get the disc burned at the shows and they're passed around so they don't use computers but they play on CD players, you can get in touch with me at Alan Watt, Site 41, Box 4. Estaire, Ontario, Canada. The postal code is P for Peter, the number 3, E for Elizabeth, the number 4, N for Nora, the number 1. P3E4N1. And I generally sift through a lot of the what's called the media today, every day, in fact, just to see what the top stories are. And that's what they're called, stories. It's somebody's story. And most of them really are just his stories, his or hers. Doesn't make any difference. They're spinners, really. Most of them are trivia. The ones from the about governments and so on are generally presented in such a fashion that you're left with a particular conclusion that you're intended to reach. So as they expose things from governments, they also close the doors on the truth at the same time. And you don't think any further. You think you've been told the truth. It's amazing how most folk cannot reason for themselves now. Brzezinski was correct when he said that shortly the public will be unable to reason or think for themselves. They'll only be able to repeat what they heard on yesterday's media. And that's happened to most people. They truly believe that the media is a sort of appendage to their survival mechanism to do the reasoning for them. What a beautiful system, and it works. Back with more after this break.
This is RBN. The Republic Broadcasting Network.
This is Alan Watt, and we're cutting through the matrix. I've mentioned over the years that people should read certain books, and one of them is the Perestroika Deception, a good expose really of the so-called Cold War, but really it was from a KGB's perspective, an ex-KGB guy who defected. And you realize, even reading it, and the more you understand, and you read books like this, you also know that the man was probably sincere of how he saw things, but he didn't know the even higher level of intelligence, which was intended to bring the Soviet Union system, the socialization collectivist type system, into the West by permission of those that set it up in the first place. And it wasn't Russia, it was the big bankers of the West. And that came out too, a lot of that came out in the Rees Commission back in the 1950s, in fact, when Norman Dodds would run the foundations, the parallel government, all belonging to the Council of Foreign Relations and so on. And to find out why they funded all these seemed to be communistic left-wing movements. And that came out in an official report from Congress that he was told by the heads of the CEOs of these corporations, these foundations, that their job was to change, radically change, and radical is the word for it, you see, the culture of the West so much that it could merge the Soviet system seamlessly with that of the West, which ties in exactly with what Lenin talks about, because the dictatorship was only supposed to last a certain time, and then communism would come in, and then, though, it would go into another phase, not quite capitalistic, not quite communistic, but they're now terming as socialistic. A more controlled society worldwide. And that seemed unbelievable at the time, but a book was published called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, well worth reading, because we're going through it all now, and it's only now that you're seeing a lot of this come into play. What was predicted back then, what was desired back then by the big foundations with their multi-trillions of dollars to spend on active non-governmental organizations. This article I'm going to read here falls into this and has to do with the oil off the U.S. coastline. And it says here, and it's from the Washington Times, the Obama administration is poised to ban offshore oil drilling on the outer continental shelf until 2012 or beyond. Beyond's the word. Meanwhile, Russia is making a bold strategic leap to begin drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico, while the United States attempts to shift gears to alternative fuels to battle the purported evils of carbon emissions, Russia will erect oil derricks off the Cuban coast. Offshore oil production makes economic sense, it creates jobs and helps fulfill America's vast energy needs. It contributes to the gross domestic product and does not increase the trade deficit. Higher oil supply helps keep a lid on rising prices, and greater American production gives the United States more influence over the global market. Drilling is also widely popular with the public. A Pew Research Center poll from February showed 63% support for offshore drilling for oil and natural gas. Americans understand the fundamental points. The oil is there and we need it. If we don't drill it out, we have to buy it from other countries. Last year, the U.S. government even helped Brazil underwrite offshore drilling in the Tupi oil field near Rio de Janeiro. The current price of oil makes drilling economically feasible, so why not let the private sector go ahead and get our oil? The Obama administration, however, views energy policy through green eye shades. It's way above Obama, obviously. Everything always is. These guys are puppets. Every aspect of his approach to energy is subordinated to radical environmental concerns. This unprecedented lack of balance is placing offshore oil resources off limits. The oil force would prefer the country shift its energy production to alternative sources such as nuclear, solar, and wind power. In theory, there's nothing wrong with that in the long run, assuming technology can catch up to demand. We have not yet reached the green utopia. We won't get there anytime soon, and America needs more oil now. Russia more sensibly views energy primarily as a strategic resource. And it is a strategy, you see. Energy is critical to Russia's economy as fuel and as a source of profit through export. Russia, by the way, has got massive oil fields all over Russia and other, all the old Soviet bloc countries. Russia has also used energy as a coercive diplomatic tool, shutting off natural gas pipe to Eastern Europe in the middle of winter to make a point about how dependent the countries are that do business with the Russians. As I say, this is way above Obama, though. This is they're just front men, these characters, who are told what to do, and they get well rewarded when they leave office for doing so. But this is the takedown of the U.S. That's the whole point of it all, is the takedown of the U.S. I've read articles here with the top environmentalists and the big foundation leaders that really are, some of them are on the boards now of governments across Europe and the U.S. and Canada, have said that there can never be another U.S. The best thing they can do to U.S. industry is dismantle it completely and flatten all the suburbs and so on and so on and so on. That is the agenda. That is the agenda. The U.S. has fulfilled its mission. It's conquered most of the world for the big boys, supplied manpower, troops, has paid through its taxation for all of that, and its reception development for weaponry, and the standardizing the world, what's left of it, to standardize into the one system. So they're pulling the rug from under the feet in the U.S., and it's obvious, too, that according to the dictates of those above or around Obama, most folk will be driving within the next 10 years or so. There'll be massive penalties for driving through carbon credits. They've said at the United Nations, that Agenda 21, that eventually it'll be essential vehicles only. Essential vehicles. That's your military, police, ambulance, bureaucratic limousines, and all the other stuff that they had in the Soviet Union. So this is all, but this is all about, really, is just that. And if you think that's bad, but remember, it ties in with the Rees Commission report. I think that's bad. Let's go on to the Mail Online, and it's like something out of a science fiction. March 19, 2010, British troops to march in Red Square, it's Moscow, for the first time in history, under a portrait of Stalin. They were uneasy allies against Adolf Hitler, and then are sworn enemies for much of the latter half of the 20th century. But now the Cold War is over, and Britain and Russia are set to come together once again to mark their stand against Nazi Germany, this time in the symbolic heart of the former Soviet Union. British troops are to march with Russian soldiers in Moscow's Red Square to mark the 65th anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany, officials confirmed today. It's believed to be the first time that British troops have ever marched in the Red Square. However, the celebration has already been mired in controversy over the city's plans to display a portrait of Soviet dictator and World War II ally Joseph Stalin in the square for the parade. During the war, they changed their slant on Stalin, and he was called Uncle Joe. He was good old Uncle Joe. After the Cold War, you always need an enemy. Keep the people, the peasants, under your thumb, and to get taxes from, so they made him the big bad bear. It's all a big game, folks. It's a game on a grand strategy, and we are the ones who are supposed to be fooled by it all. And most folk are. If realized, the plans would break a major taboo in Russia, it says here. For many, Stalin remains the butcher who sent hundreds of thousands of Communist Party men to their deaths and political purges. He also counseled to condemn millions of peasants to die during man-made famines in the early 30s, that was the Ukraine, and within Russia too, some parts. But for most modern Russians, Stalin's also the victor of World War II and the greatest hero of the Soviet century. As the Soviet Union was brought to her knees in 1991, Stalin remained a symbol of Russian power. It's a sad thing, too. The ordinary folk really worship power for all that they worship. See, people who worship things are always afraid of it at the same time. It's a sadomasochistic relationship. They're terrified of someone who has such power, and they treat them like a god. Like an Old Testament god in a bad mood who might just smile once in a while, throw a favor away, or have you decapitated. That's what they respect, unfortunately. And that's why we're going through the censure of change under the guise of anti-terrorism, which is really a war of terror on the public, because we obey much more easily when we're terrified. This is how the world's always been run, by psychopathic groups. And these psychopathic groups that get to the top of each nation eventually intermarry each other as well. That happened all through the history of Europe, for instance, and before Europe. And they then are internationalists. They don't care if they preside over a country as kings or queens for a couple of hundred years and then hop off to another place that they own for another couple of hundred years. It's all the same to them, which peasants they're ruling over. And the public respect fear is not something, eh? Is not something. So here's troops ready to march under Stalin. And, as I say, go back to the Rees Commission and read it. Folks, read the Rees Commission. In fact, the Norman Dodds report is up on YouTube somewhere. I might have the link. I had it before. I might drag it up and you can watch it again. And people didn't believe him at the time. Even the Congress, although they accepted it as factual. We live in a double state when we see things like this or hear things like this. We understand it on an intellectual level, but we don't really want to believe it. Yeah, we're living through the consequences of it all. The collectivization, the new society, the Club of Rome's dream of a collectivist society based on the Soviet-type model is all coming true right now under environmentalism and conservation. Quite something indeed. And I've read this little article before, but it's time to do it again. The Times of India. It takes the Times of India to tell you what's happening in the US, to show you that Agenda 21 is underway. And it's about Detroit being demolished around the outskirts right now. Back with more after this break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
I'm Alan Watt, and we're cutting through the matrix. I mentioned previously, too, that something I said about the takedown of America, the U.S., and how it was planned that way a long time ago, and how the big green boys on board the Obama train are all behind it. And then you see, as I say, that they're falling out stuff they talked about maybe 10, 50, even 20 years ago, some of these greeny leaders, environmentalists, who prior to that were preaching solely, really, about cutting the population. They didn't have the idea then of blaming the weather for all problems caused by too many people. There were just too many people. That was the basic point they used to, the mantra they used to give back in the 70s, etc. But here's an article here too about the Detroit. Now, Detroit really was the power base for industry in the U.S., the big, big, massive power base. And remember, if you truly are a nation that can do anything, including defend itself, you have to have a big industrial base to produce the machinery for war. What are you going to do if you go to war with some of the big boys that are producing things for your weaponry? Obviously, they're going to stop giving you replacement parts for your weapons if you're at war with them. So you understand, we're already international. There are no enemies out there going to take down the U.S. through physical war, unless it's just a matter of bringing them in to decimate the population and bring down the quota of populace to be allowed to be alive. But this article, as I say, is from India, the Times of India, March 10th. To save itself, Detroit plans to shrink. And it says, Detroit, the very symbol of American industrial might for most of the 20th century, is drawing up a radical renewal plan that calls for turning large swaths of this now blighted, rusted-out city back into the fields and farmlands that existed before the automobile. Operating on a scale never before attempted in this country, the city would demolish houses in some of the most desolate sections of Detroit and move residents into stronger neighborhoods. Now, stronger means denser, the one you packed in like sardines for the brave new century world we're into now. Roughly a quarter of the 139 square mile city could go from urban to semi-rural. Near downtown, fruit trees and vegetable farms would replace neighborhoods that are in an eerie landscape of empty buildings and vacant lots. Suburban commuters heading into the city center might pass through what looks like the countryside to get there. surviving neighborhoods and the auto industry's birthplace will become pockets and expanses of green. Mayor David Bing, who took office last year, is expected to unveil some details in his State of the City address this month. Now, I read an article months ago where Obama mentioned it because some other fellow had come up with the plan for it. And then I went into what architects are being taught these days. And lo and behold, from Australia, it comes, and remember, all architects are up on things at the same time across the world. In Australia, they're building machines, talking about building massive machines to take down urban areas, huge things like sci-fi monsters. And I realized, well, if that's been taught to guys coming out of colleges for architects, then how long have they been teaching that? And it's years and years and years. They were already preparing the architects to design these things and engineers to design these things 20 years ago for what's happening now. Everything's done way ahead, long before we ever get a sniff of it. But you do get a strong smell of it for sure, a pong, you might say, if you go into the writings of the Council on Foreign Relations and its members and all the green foundations that are out there too, because they were talking about this 30, 40 years ago. So Mr. Mayor Bing, who took office last year, is expected to unveil some details in his State of the City address this month. Things that were unthinkable are now becoming thinkable, said James Hughes of Rutgers University, who's among the urban experts. You see, we have urban experts now watching the experiment with interest. There's now a realization that past glories are never going to be recaptured. You better understand what he's saying there. You're never going back to being able to be self-sufficient again. Remember that word, interdependence, and all the treaties that we're signing at the United Nations? That means you'll be totally dependent for everything you need coming from abroad. And we already almost are. Some people probably don't accept that, it says, but that is the reality. The meaning of what is afoot is now settling in across the city. People are afraid, said Deborah Younger, executive director of a group called Detroit Local Initiative Support Corporation, that's working to revitalize five areas of the city. When you read that neighbors may no longer exist, that sends fear. Though the will to downsize has arrived, the way to do it is unclear and fraught with problems. Politically explosive decisions must be made about which neighborhoods should be bulldozed and which improved. Hundreds of millions of federal dollars will be needed to buy land, raise buildings, and relocate residents, since this financially desperate state does not have the means to do it on its own. It's known how many people in the mostly black, blue-collar city might be uprooted, but it could be thousands. Many thousands, I'd say. And that was in the plans a long time ago. And here it comes into actuality. Actuality. Now, I've mentioned so many, many times that we've always really been in a kind of feudal system. Although Professor Carl Quigley said the New World Order they're bringing in through the Council on Foreign Relations, the parallel government, is based on a form of feudalism, a new form of corporate overlords, CEO overlords, and that's how it will be. We've really been there for an awful long time. We've never had what we thought was democracy. We've had showcase elections for an awful long time, but the bankers have always ruled. And when we talk about the bankers, we'll come back from this break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Alan Watts, and we're cutting through the matrix. Talking about the big gangs, or gangsters, that's where the word comes from, that run the world. And they have amalgamations of gangs as well that work in certain areas where they have to get along. You've all seen the old movies of the Mafia and how they divide up a city and have their meetings. They're all semi-enemies towards each other because they're all jealous of each other's territory. But they'd get together and be a big gang and hammer out their minutes of their meetings for their agendas and how they would continue to do business together. Well, that's really how the world's always been. But you go back into the old goldsmiths and how they started to give out basically checks. The Knights Templars were the first to do it, in fact, from London. And that's what they call the Chancellor of the Exchequer. They actually worked out the Templars actually worked out the debt and profits on a massive chessboard, a draft board they called it there, an outdoor one with big long sticks to move the pieces. And that's still there today, yet. But they're really a gang. They're called a priesthood or not, doesn't make any difference. A gang's a gang. They've all sworn their oaths to uphold each other, and they are all that matters. And they'll stand up against anyone together and lie for each other and kill for each other. That's really what brotherhoods were always all about. But it's the same thing up the way through nobilities as well, because they have their own particular gangs and noble knighthoods, etc., and awards to give to each other. And it's got to be an oath you take with each higher position you're given, as you're let in on the bigger secrets, which is generally the handling of the general public and how to souse them even more of tax money. So at the bottom level, whenever they say the federal government is running something, you always think, in every country, you always think, well, it must be legit. They've got appointed people watching things like banks and so on. And it never dawns on you it's just as corrupt, because government itself is just another big gang that serves the bankers. They get paid after the bankers have got their cut. They get paid good wages and big payoffs and so on. That's what it's about. All work and labor comes from the public. Doesn't matter if it's kings or queens living off you, with armies to force you to give up your pigs or your sheep or your goats or whatever you've got there, and your corn. Or it's a government that you think is even better when you think you elect them, and then they up your taxes and take things from you. Well, you know, we voted them in. That's it, how it goes, isn't it? It's a great con game. But here's an article here from the Washington Times about the bank regulators in the U.S. who, during the boom years, were giving, and these are the federal employees, they were giving each other massive bonuses as well. It wasn't just the bank operatives. It was the federal overseers. It says three agencies paid out $19 million during the boom, despite mistakes. Wall Street financial firms weren't the only ones giving big bonuses in the boom years before the worst financial crisis in generations. The government also was handing out millions of dollars to bank regulators, rewarding superior work, even as an avalanche of risky mortgages helped create the meltdown. The payments detailed in payroll data released to the Associated Press under the Freedom of Information Act are the latest evidence of the government's false sense of security during the go-go days of the financial boom. Just as bank executives got bonuses despite taking on dangerous amounts of risk, regulators got taxpayer-funded bonuses despite missing or ignoring signs that the system was on the verge of a meltdown. The bonuses were part of a reward program little known outside the government, as a lot of those goes on, little known by the general public. Some government regulators got tens of thousands of dollars in perks, boosting their salaries by almost 25%. Often the rewards amounted to just a few hundred dollars for employees who came up with good ideas. I wonder what their good ideas were. It's really how it deceived the public, you know, their good ideas. During the 2003 to 2006 boom, the three agencies that supervise most U.S. banks, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corps, FDIC, the Office of the Thrift Supervisation, OTS, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, gave out at least $19 million in bonuses, records show. Nearly all that money was spent recognizing superior performance. These guys were all in on the act that we're going to have a crash. They helped it along. And what they were doing there was rewarding themselves before the dollar became worthless, making sure they had enough in the kitty for their own futures. That's what it's about. The largest share, more than $8.4 million, went to financial examiners, those employees and managers who scrutinize internal bank documents and sound the first alarms. Analysts, auditors, economists, and criminal investigators also got awards. It's all about the fox guarding the hens. They're all at it, aren't they? After the meltdown, the government's internal investigators surveyed the wet wreckage of nearly 200 failed banks and repeatedly found that those regulators had not done enough. Well, they hadn't done anything, did they? but really, what's new, eh? This is the, I call it tripe, you know. This is the tripe they hand out to the public for news. It's almost like, ha, 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 what are you going to do about it? I mean, that's really what it's like, isn't it? Isn't it really? After you've been screwed 1,000 times in all ways, they come out and tell you this just to rub it in your face and mock you. And that's what they do at the top. They mock you because, after all, you're down below saying, oh, well, most folk don't care. They don't care. And so the dollar in their pocket's worth nothing. That's when they care. This article here is about the same kind of thing, Mail Online, from the UK, March 19th. Royal Bank of Scotland boss walks off with a £13 million pension. That's about $24 million. So if you thought the fat cats had gone, you'd be wrong, it says here. Now, I think 80% of that's government-owned, by the way. So it's the US, it's the London, I call it London. London is the government. It's the London boys who own the bank. A top executive at the Royal Bank of Scotland will enjoy a pension worth an astonishing £582,000 per year. I wonder how the poor soul will manage. The disgraced bank revealed yesterday. A huge payout to Gordon Pell, 60, who leaves the bank at the end of the month, is even more generous than that handed to the bank's former boss, Sir Fred the Shred Goodwin, which caused a national uproar last year. This guy rub it in your face. The gold-plated retirement with the equivalent of a £13.6 million pension pot will enrage taxpayers who own 84% of the bailed-out RBS. Well, I love how they say that, that we own. That's what I'm saying, that the left socialism, is it? Well, it's really the public who own the bank. Well, where's your dividends, eh? You don't see a penny of it. See, we're all slaves, you see, under all these gangs. Perception's distorted, and the public really are trained to believe the distortion. Quite something, indeed. I mentioned before, too, about how the leaders are hand-picked and told beforehand and coached for maybe a few years before they make them prime ministers or presidents. They'd never ever let someone in that was the genuine article, and Professor Carl Quigley also said the same thing on behalf of the Council on Foreign Relations. He says, we always make sure the top people are our boys on all parties. It's no different than in the Soviet system, where you could vote for maybe four politicians, but they all belong to the Politburo, one-party system. It says here, Tony Blair, Blair's fight to keep his oil cash secret, former PM's deals are revealed as his earnings since 2007. This is a poor prime minister, a Labour guy, you know, for the working people, the Fabianist as well, right? Reached £20 million. That's what he's earned since he left office. Well, what they do, you see, they pay you off legally through the means that's mentioned in this article here. Tony Blair waged an extraordinary two-year battle to keep secret a lucrative deal with a multinational oil giant which has extensive interests in Iraq. The former prime minister tried to keep the public in the dark over his dealings with South Korean oil firm UI Energy Corporation. Mr. Blair, who's made at least £20 million since leaving Downing Street in June 2007, also went to great efforts to keep hidden a £1 million deal advising the royal family in Iraq's neighbour, Kuwait. In an unprecedented move, he persuaded the committee which vets the jobs of former ministers to keep details of both deals from the public for 20 months, claiming it was commercially sensitive. The deals emerged yesterday when the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments finally lost patience with Mr. Blair and decided to ignore his objections and publish the details. News of the secret deals fueled fresh accusations that Mr. Blair is cashing in on his contracts from the controversial Iraq War and what one MP called revolving door politics at its worst. Well, see, these are his payoffs for being a little war boy for the big boys who rule Britain. That's how they reward you. They can't give you straight cash for taking the whole country to war and doing their bidding and making sure the taxpayer funded it all. That would kind of stink. So they call it paying. They give you payments for, how about $1 million for a payment for appearing at a speech, for instance, a dinner, and giving a half-hour speech at the end of it. Do you think the public paid for that at the dinner? Of course they don't. Do you think they give you £4 or £5 million or dollars up front for a book on your memoirs that no one's going chaos. That's how it's done. It's always been done this way. It says here, the Christigan says that Mr. Blair is using his role as the West Middle East envoy for personal gain. Revelations also shed fresh light on his astonishing earnings, which include lucrative after-dinner speaking, consultancies with banks and foreign governments, a generous advance for his forthcoming memoirs, as well as the pension and other perks he enjoyed as a former Prime Minister. The full extent of his income is cloaked in secrecy now, listen to this, because this is the guy supposed to, this is all done for him. And I'll read it this way, it's been constructed for him, a complex web of shadowy companies and partnerships which let him avoid publishing full accounts detailing all the money from his commercial ventures and also hide all his taxable income as well. It's done by the big boys that run the system, the guys that put him in there, the little war boy. That's how it's done. That's the real world, folks. That's the real world. We've all been trained to believe that somehow altruistic beings are up there being attentive to you like angels. And you never see their fangs. You never see their fangs. You just never see it. It's all your perceptions and how they've been distorted purposely by scientific indoctrination and repetition. And guys in $5,000, $10,000 suits that you think, oh, well, they're winners. They're respectable people. They must have got up there because they're respectable and decent and honest and hardworking and very thrifty. You get up at the top because you're a psychopath. Nothing stands in your way, and you'll do whatever your superiors tell you to do to get up there. Because they have no qualms about it. Well, Tony, you have to take the country to war in a few years' time. What do you think of that? Okay, what's in it for me, boss? You know, that's how it really works. Well, we can't pay you off while you're Prime Minister with the weight you have left, like all the rest before you. You know. And then we'll pay you off. That's how it's done. I will hide all this cash from the public and the taxman. Don't worry, our boys own all that stuff. We own the government. You know, don't worry about that. They'll set up all the stuff for you and cover your behind. That's how it's really done. Perception is the biggest thing of all. There's a movie just come out. It's called Order of Chaos. And I've got some voiceovers in it. And that kind of deals with how your perceptions have been indoctrinated into you with scientific indoctrination techniques. And that's how movies are made. Once in a while you get one that's got some controversy in it, and that's what starts off the thinking process. Things that upset you at times, you need to get a bit of upsetting to break your conditioning. Without going crazy into alien land or whatever. Yeah. Everything's been covered, even where you go. As I say, it's like waking up, it's kind of like coming from a tunnel into a field, and you walk upwards, and then you get into the top of the tunnel, and you see the field in front of you, and there's a forest on the other side of a field. And you want to get into that forest because it looks so beautiful. You've got to walk up across this landmine, really, this field, before you get there. And the big boys make sure there's 1,000 avenues that you're going to veer off into to put you in loops, take you in the outer space and back with all kinds of crazy ideas, rather than say, here are the historical facts which are published in the right places. Boring stuff. Most of you will never make it because you can't concentrate long enough to go through these boring books. So you'd rather believe in the fantasy. It can't be human. Humans would never do this. Read your histories of the world. It's been like that since probably day one. That's the reality of the world. Corruption can be legalized. If you own the governments, you are the law. Now, there's Lindsay from Georgia on the line there. I'll take his call now. He's there. Hello, Lindsay. Lindsay? Hello? Is everybody there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
Oh, hey, Alan. Listen, I just wanted to tell you and all of your listeners about the Mark Glenn interview wherein Dr. Zabrowski, Dr. Alan Zabrowski, the former director of studies at the U.S. Army War College, came out and said that the generals and the military apparatus know that Israel carried out 9/11. Do I have a couple of minutes to give some details?
Well, you could actually mention which articles it's in.
Right. The interview can be found at www.theuglytruth.wordpress.com. Now, for a discussion on this, you can go to www.theinfounderground.com. It'll be found in the current news section. There's a very lengthy discussion going on in other forums above Top Secret. Now, I never go there, but it's the ATS forum above Top Secret. They have four pages just within, like, I think 6 hours. So within 4 days, it's made its way to at least six different forums. YouTube, there are several YouTubes. It's been on Rents.com now. So
this is not an advertising show where you can come on and rattle off all the different things here.
What you really just do is
mention where they can find it one place and leave them to it. If they can't find things for themselves on high-speed internet, then they can't think either, you know.
Well, the reason that I was giving so many different sites is because this is not going to go away, Alan. The Arabs don't control Hollywood, and Ben has been did not do 9/11. Basically, the gauntlet's been thrown down. The liars and the lying lies that they're telling are no longer going to be accepted. When you have a man who is former director of studies at the U.S. Army War College coming out and saying that Israel did it, everything that's happening to our world right now is because of a bigger issue. A world domination by the Zionists.
I know. But hold on. We'll be back after this break.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
This is Alan Watt, and we're cutting through the matrix, talking to Lindsay from Georgia about Israel's involvement and 9/11 and so on. Continue.
Okay, Alan, thank you. Now, I've got the clip queued up to where he comes out with the revelation, and it can be found on YouTube directly if you type in, "The military knows," in all caps, "knows," is all caps, "Israel did 9/11. Here it is, okay?
Yeah.
You have people who try to make this claim that they are loyal to America and at the same time loyal to a foreign government, it is a lie.
It is, and it's more than that, Mark. What we need to stand up and say is not only did they attack the USS Liberty, they did 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
They did it. I have had long conversations over the past 2 weeks with contacts at the Army War College, at its headquarters, Marine Corps, and I've made it absolutely clear in both cases that it is 100% certain that 9/11 was a Mossad operation.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't do any more. I've heard this kind of stuff before. I can remember when they caught a bunch of Israelis on an opposite tower right after 9/11, at the same time, I should say. And they were all Mossad guys under the guise of student visas in the U.S. at the time. This is old stuff, and it won't go anywhere. Honestly, it won't go anywhere.
You're saying it won't go anywhere. However, this is...
I've heard so many generals come out over the years on Patriot Radio saying similar stuff and other stuff, too. And it really doesn't work on the general public. It won't make a damn... You don't understand. This is the U.S. The U.S. has been run by the same bunch who's run London for an awful long time. Israel's the same thing, too.
No, it's not London.
You know?
I'm not saying London or the German death cult is doing this, Alan. The man, the former director of studies at the U.S. Army War College, came out and said Israel did it and the military knows it. Alan...
But you've got to give the proof of it. You can't just make the statement. It's only the proof that makes any difference in anybody's logical mind.
But that's the point. The proof has already been shown from top, from every which way but loose, Alan. I'm not.
Well, what does it tell you? What does it tell you if your own government knows the same stuff as you do and you're talking about right now, and there's nothing about it?
Look, I don't.
What does it tell you? What does it tell you?
It tells me. Okay, you're asking me a question. Let me give you the answer. It tells me that they are so afraid of their puppet masters, and they're not sitting only in London or only in New York. They're sitting also in Tel Aviv, mm-hmm. also in Paris, France. That they. Their control, and I admit, Alan, they are a formidable enemy to humanity. And yes, they are.
Well, FDR himself said anybody who ignores the New York vote in politics is utterly doomed.
But, Alan.
And it's always been that way in the U.S. as well. And as to say, you've got money cliques, these intermarried families, 13 main families run the entire financial system of the entire planet. And they're the boys who comprise the International Monetary Fund. These are the guys who set up wars, profit off them, absolutely. They buy and sell countries overnight by crashing your economies and all the rest of it. This is all well-known stuff. But the thing is, what are you going to do about it?
Well, you know what?
That's the end of the show coming in. But I've had this stuff ongoing for years and years and years coming out. And everybody knows that money rules the world. There's no doubt about it. I've mentioned it 1,000,000,000 times. We're all working for it like little mice. And no one's ever come up with an alternative system. You know something else? No one else would risk it. That's the problem with human nature. From Hamish, myself, and Interior Canada, it's good night. May your God or your gods go with you.